KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
A U.S. senator was forced to the ground and handcuffed today at a press conference with the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security.
We will ask a senior official in that department what happened this Thursday, June 12th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. What's the future of government funding for foreign aid and public broadcasting as the House votes on clawbacks?
We can have free speech in America. The government just doesn't need to fund it.
Also this hour, turns out the way we breathe can reveal things like whether we're depressed or getting enough sleep.
We view the world through the nose. When you inhale, namely sniff, then you have information. And if you're not sniffing, you don't have information, period.
Plus, dinosaur food.
Scientists have found the preserved gut contents of a sauropod.
What was in there after this news?
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Israel has carried out dozens of attacks against Iranian targets tonight. That's according to an Israeli military official who spoke to NPR. The official saying Israel is targeting the country's nuclear sites. Explosions are reported to be heard northeast of Iran's capital, Tehran. The reported strikes come as the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, for the first time in 20 years, has censured Iran over its failure to work with inspectors. An Iranian retaliation could be swift based on previous escalations. President Donald Trump today repeated previous remarks that Iran, quote, cannot have a nuclear weapon. The House today narrowly passed a rescission package, taking back $9.4 billion from foreign aid and from public media, including NPR and PBS. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports.
Last week, the administration handed Congress the formal request to take back money lawmakers had already approved for USAID. The cuts include nearly $1 billion to global health programs related to HIV/AIDS, curbing infectious diseases, and reducing childhood deaths. It would cut $168 million to international bodies like the World Health Organization and $200 million from international peacekeeping missions. Many of these programs have already been cut or defunded by the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Those moves have been challenged in court, sometimes successfully. So the White House asked Congress to formally rescind the funds, which they say go to programs antithetical to U.S. interests. The House narrowly passed the measure by just two votes. The Senate has until July 18th to vote. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
President Trump is set to travel to the G7, which starts Monday. In his first term, the summits were acrimonious, as Trump's America First stance has made cooperation difficult. This year, there's one less opportunity for disagreement. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports.
At these summits, the leaders of seven advanced economies meet to coordinate on things like conflict and economic policy. The meetings usually end with a joint statement, often called a communique, laying out what they agreed on. At this year's G7 in Kananaskis, Alberta, there will be no communique. A White House official speaking on background told NPR that instead, leaders will release their own standalone statements. They added that the decision was, quote, the preference of our Canadian hosts. After 2018's G7, Trump abruptly withdrew approval of the communique and insulted then-Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, after Trudeau threatened to retaliate against U.S. tariffs. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
241 passengers and crew are dead after the crash of an Air India flight that went down in India shortly after takeoff. Dozens on the ground, many of them students at a medical college, were also killed when the plane crashed. India's home minister has confirmed a single passenger on board the plane survived. It was a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow's up more than 100 points. You're listening to NPR. The Israeli military says it has recovered the bodies of two hostages that were held in Gaza. The recovery leaves around 33 deceased and about 20 living hostages still captive there, according to the Israeli government. NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi reports.
The Israeli military said it has brought home the bodies of 59-year-old Yair Yaakov and another hostage whose name was not yet cleared for publication. It said the operation was carried out by Israel's special military forces. Yaakov was a father of three and a farmer who lived on kibbutz near Oz. He was killed and his body taken to Gaza in the Hamas-led attacks of October 7, 2023. His son and partner were also abducted on October 7th. They were returned alive in the hostage deal of November 2023. Some family members of hostages still held in Gaza have been calling for an immediate ceasefire and an end to the war to bring back their loved ones. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump signed a resolution today that would block California's first-in-the-nation rule banning the sale of new gas-powered cars in the state by 2035. California quickly challenged the move in court. The resolution to block California's strict emission standards was approved by Congress last month. Trump also signed measures to overturn state policies curbing tailpipe emissions in certain vehicles and smog-forming nitrogen oxide pollution from trucks. Crude oil futures prices fell slightly today as traders took some profits from a recent run-up, oil dropping 11 cents a barrel to end the session at $67.97 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. At this moment, Southern California here is at the center of the national immigration debate in Los Angeles. Protests continue during an increase in federal immigration enforcement. Immigration raids around here have recently targeted a clothing factory, a Home Depot, several car washes, and farms in surrounding counties. President Trump has deployed thousands of National Guard troops and hundreds of U.S. Marines to L.A. over the objections of the city's mayor and the state's governor. And this afternoon, California Senator Alex Padilla, a Democrat, was thrown to the ground, handcuffed, and forcibly removed from a press conference for the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem. For more on all of this, we're joined now by Assistant Secretary for Border and Immigration Policy, Tony Pham. Welcome.
Ms. Chang, thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you for being with us. So I want to ask you a little bit more about that incident at the press conference for your department secretary. I understand that Noem and Padilla did briefly meet afterwards. Do you know what they talked about?
I don't have any visibility on any conversation that happened subsequent to the incident.
Okay. Well, why do you think federal law enforcement officers felt that they had to physically subdue and handcuff the senator?
Well, I suspect in their training, when they see or sense that there may be a disruption or a threat to the secretary, they have to engage the individual. So without truly having any visibility on what Mr. Padilla did during that period of time, I can only rely on the fact that these individuals act and react to the situation that is actually placed before them.
Okay, well, we do have visibility on the video, and Senator Padilla is heard identifying himself as Senator Alex Padilla. But let me go on to ask you, Padilla
Ms. Chang, if I may.
Yes,
I can respect the fact that he holds the position of senator, but I will always say this. Senators can engage in conduct that could present a threat as well, right? Just because you hold a particular title, you're not held to any lower of a standard of behavior. So I will just say as you mentioned that he has a senator and he identified him as a senator, but the question still becomes, what was his conduct that was perceived by the individual law enforcement officers to take their actions?
Well, Padilla explained his conduct. He told reporters that he came to that press conference to get more information because he had been unable to get a meeting with DHS officials. When is the last time that you briefed Senator Padilla and other Democratic lawmakers about your actions?
In particular, as the former Assistant Secretary at mm-hmm. Homeland Security, mm-hmm. I have not.
Okay. Do you know when DHS officials in general have last briefed Democratic lawmakers about these enforcement actions?
Yeah, not when they last have briefed. I do understand the process is they will get requests to be able to present before certain committees and certain members and staffers, and then they typically at DHS accommodate those requests.
All right, let's talk about the protests here in Los Angeles. Local law enforcement has been saying for days now that they do not need the National Guard or the U.S. Marines. What specific functions do you believe these federal troops have provided that local law enforcement has not been providing?
Well, I think when we draw on our past experience of what we witnessed and at times what we personally endured and watched in the past in 2020, in the summer of 2020, when cities such as Portland, Seattle, Chicago began to burn because of poor decision-making from leadership in those cities, I think the function and the response by the administration to send in federal law enforcement officers to include the National Guard is absolutely 100% appropriate to help send a aggressive and forceful response to the individual law-abiding citizens and the business owners in LA that are suffering now because of the looting and the rioting.
Let's ground this in some evidence. Over the last two nights, there have been 274 arrests for failure to disperse, an additional 24 arrests for curfew violations. We're not talking about a picture of overwhelming violence here. Does it seem like the LAPD has things under control at the moment?
Well, I would think that they can provide some solace that they have federal support, and that's what led to their ability to maintain order, and that they have the resources from the federal government to be able to you know, impose those curfews.
You think the federal troops are solely responsible for the order that we see today in Los Angeles?
No, that's not what I said. I think in a partnership model, which should have occurred at the very beginning, Ms. Chang, I think in that partnership model, it's perfectly okay to accept and acknowledge that having a federal and National Guard presence in the city to help guard property for the federal purposes or federal property frees up, you know, a certain number of individuals so that way they can focus on imposing the curfews. So this isn't just I would never take a position in the context of law enforcement and public safety that one particular department should be solely responsible mm-hmm. for everything. This is a partnership, and quite frankly, given some of the rhetoric that comes from the governor out there and the mayor Bass and even the chief prosecutor and the chief of police at the initial phase of when things began to percolate, demonizing ICE officers, demonizing ICE in general. I think it's okay to simply say in partnership, you know, because the federal authorities are out there and military presence is out there, they were able to push forward and maintain and reinstitute order.
But tell me, for those Americans out there watching all of this right now who are feeling scared about the idea of the U.S. military potentially suppressing their right to free speech, what would you like to say to those Americans?
I would like for them to understand that had we received, as Americans, forthright decision-making from liberal governors and liberal mayors who need to support their law enforcement, if they had made critical decisions at the very beginning to deploy their local law enforcement at the very beginning, then this issue could have very well potentially been avoided. But we have seen how those poor decision-making processes and matrices played out years ago. And so the reaction is a preventative one, and I think it worked out.
Do you foresee military troops being deployed to other cities where immigration raids or other immigration enforcement actions will take place?
I would foresee and anticipate, and I can't speak for the administration, but I would anticipate if the leadership in those localities fail to take necessary positions to deploy their law enforcement officials out there to help maintain order and protect the law-abiding citizens, I would forecast that military presence through National Guard there
All
would
right.
be appropriate.
Assistant Secretary for Border and Immigration Policy, Tony Pham, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today, the Supreme Court made it easier for students with disabilities to enforce their rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act and other federal laws which ensure disabled children get equal opportunities to learn in public schools. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Writing for a unanimous court, Chief Justice John Roberts said that while today's decision may be narrow, that does not diminish its importance for a great many children with disabilities, children who face, quote, daunting challenges on a daily basis. We hold today, he said, that those challenges do not include having to satisfy a more stringent standard of proof than other plaintiffs in discrimination cases. At the center of today's opinion was Ava Tharp, a teenage girl who suffers from serious disabilities caused by a rare form of epilepsy. She has so many seizures, mostly in the morning hours, that her public school in Kentucky arranged her schedule to be in the afternoon only, including a teacher who gave her instruction at home in the early evening. But when the Tharp family moved to Minnesota for her father's job, her new school in the Twin Cities refused to accommodate her late day schedule. So Ava was only getting 2/3 of the instructional time in school that other kids were getting. After years of litigation, the Osseo area school system relented. But the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals denied the Tharps' claims for compensatory damages, essentially reimbursement of expenses, including experts, outside teachers, and lawyers needed to get equal treatment for their child. The appellate court said that the Tharps did not meet the high standard of proof needed to prevail, specifically that they failed to prove that the school system acted in bad faith or with gross misjudgment. Today, the Supreme Court reversed that ruling, calling its reasoning, quote, wrong.
So this is, for us, this is bigger than our family.
Ava's father, Aaron Tharp, told NPR that the most important thing about today's ruling is that it gives other families who don't have the resources he does the tools to fight back.
This battle for us has always been about other families and their right of access for their children to educational opportunities. And so knowing that they have another tool that they can use to fight for those protections, fight for the right of access, is extremely important to me.
A statement from the Osseo area schools noted that while the court overruled the showing of bad faith needed to prevail in this case, the justices did not specify what the standard should be. That said, the language of today's opinion strongly suggested that Congress has already made its view clear in the text of the statute by linking federal funding to specific protections for children with disabilities. Indeed, as Roberts observed, Congress at one point even amended the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act to overturn a Supreme Court decision that had failed to interpret the statute in the expansive way that Congress intended. While today's decision was unanimous and joined by all the justices, there were concurring opinions from the right and left of the court. On the right, Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Justice Kavanaugh, left the door open for future rulings that might restrict the liability of schools. And on the left, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by Justice Jackson, said that the plain text of the law reaches cases involving a failure to accommodate, even where no ill will or animus towards people with disabilities is present. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Mathnasium, whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It is time once again for our science news roundup from Shortwave. That is NPR's science podcast. Reporting this time, Regina Barber and Rachel Carlson. Welcome, you two.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hi.
Hey, so you have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. I have to say there's some real mind benders this time.
Yeah, we have a little bit of everything for you, from a device that shows people have unique breathing fingerprints
to what's really in a dinosaur's stomach.
And an unexpected reason why droughts are getting worse.
Okay, let's take them in order. Humans with unique breathing fingerprints? Explain.
Yeah, okay, Mary Louise, Gina, I want you both to take a big breath through your noses.
Through I was like noses. Holding my breath.
Okay.
So that sniff you
can
just
can we breathe
took,
out?
Yeah, you can breathe out. Stole? You can breathe out.
Okay, we're ready.
Okay, that sniff you just took is giving your brain information about your environment, the studio you're in.
We view the world through the nose. When you inhale, namely sniff, then you have information. And if you're not sniffing, you don't have information, period.
That's Noam Sobel. He's a neurobiologist and one of the study authors for this paper that came out this week in the journal Current Biology. He told me the olfactory system, like our noses, nasal breathing, our sense of smell, is really important for how the human brain functions. Every breath we take is linked to how we interpret and move through the world. Like, for one example, when we're planning out our language, or even during this conversation we're having now, our noses are involved. We have to figure out when to breathe. Or when we're doing things like working out, our noses are important, basically.
So Noam says since people's brains are unique, he and other researchers wondered if human nasal breathing patterns were like also unique. So he and his team developed this device that monitored 100 people's airflow for 24 hours. And participants wore it while they went through their daily activities. It kind of looked like those small oxygen tubes that go in your nose.
I am picturing this. Okay. But I am struggling to wrap my head around the idea that we humans all have unique nasal fingerprints. Explain that.
Yeah, so they saw that just based on people's breathing patterns, they could tell how participants were likely to score on levels of depression, the kind of sleep they were getting, anxiety. Wow. So, for example, people who scored higher on anxiety questionnaires also had shorter inhales than people who scored lower on those questionnaires, even though none of the participants had actually been diagnosed with anxiety. So Noam says he wonders if this tool could be used to help identify mental or physical health problems in the future.
Well, and I'm wondering about what's cause and what's effect here. If we can change the way we breathe, could that change our health?
So this study can't tell researchers that, but Noam says hopefully with more research and new tools, we can learn more about like whether breathing could make a difference for things like anxiety or depression.
All right. My yoga instructor and I will be paying close attention
I think
to
many
the,
people
to
will.
The future
yeah.
studies. All right. Breathing deeply through my nose. Moving on. Dinosaurs eating.
Yeah.
Gina, what we got?
Yeah, specifically, we're going to talk about a sauropod's last meal. So sauropods are huge dinosaurs, like over 50 feet tall with long necks, small heads. They also eat plants. Think Littlefoot from Land Before Time or like the Sinclair Oil logo.
This is like your stereotypical classic brontosaurus-looking
exactly.
dinosaur.
Yes.
Go on.
Yeah, and paleontologists have labeled them herbivores, vegetarians, based on educated guesses from things like their teeth and their body shape.
There's a reason every kid knows that sauropod dinosaurs ate plants. It's because, first of all, it's hard to imagine them eating anything else, but also because scientists have thought about exactly how they were able to do that. They don't chew. They snip and swallow, and then they ferment.
That's paleontologist Stephen Porapat, who's the lead author on a study published in the journal Current Biology. For the first time, Stephen and a team of paleontologists and volunteers in Queensland, Australia, found the preserved gut contents of a sauropod.
The preserved gut contents?
Yeah.
What were they?
Yeah. So once they confirmed that like these fossils were truly like just from the stomach, they saw a variety of plants, like even conifers, like pine trees we have today.
We know from other fossils what kind of plants were available, but we wouldn't necessarily expect all of them to be on the menu.
So Stephen says he was surprised to see flowering plants in the gut, which had just shown up during the Cretaceous period when this dinosaur lived. So he says the evolution of flowering plants might have affected the evolution of sauropods too.
And vice versa. By the way, they named the dinosaur Judy after one of the founders of the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum in Winton, Queensland. And we should say that Judy the dino is like one data point. It's what Judy last ate. So Stephen and other paleontologists are like cautious about generalizing all sauropod diets based on this like one finding, but it's a good start.
All right. Topic three. Let's move on to our last one. This is why droughts are getting worse. I'm going to go out on a limb here and venture this might be linked to climate change.
Yes, but it's not only because there's less rain. So recent work published in the journal Nature found that one reason droughts could be getting worse is because the atmosphere is getting thirstier.
Thirstier. Explain that.
Yeah, one climate scientist who worked on the study, Chris Funk, says it has to do with the chemistry of the atmosphere.
As nitrogen and oxygen molecules heat up, they bounce around more, and that leaves more space in between them for water vapor.
So when the air is warmer, like with climate change, the atmosphere can hold more moisture. It can pull water from like rivers, lakes, and soil. Scientists have known that both of these things happen. But since with climate change, extreme rainfall events are also increasing, they didn't know how big of an effect it was having.
So how did they figure that out? Which effect was the more powerful?
They used a big computer model, which is something lots of other climate studies do. The scientists fed it both rainfall and evaporation data from a 40-year span, 1981 to 2022. And then they looked at drought trends. And they found that the global drought area jumped from 10 to 30%, with drought levels really accelerating in the last 5 years of the study.
And because of the warmer and thus like thirstier atmosphere, droughts got 40% worse in the period they studied. And in some places, droughts were 60% worse because of it, like in Africa, South America, Australia, and the Southwest US.
Okay, so let me try to just get this in layman's terms. You're telling me droughts are getting worse, and we think this is because the atmosphere is warmer, so it can suck up water faster than rainfall can replace it?
Yes, which means dry areas are getting drier, but wet areas are also getting drier.
Mm-hmm.
We talked to hydrologist Yadu Pakrel, who wasn't involved in the work, and he says because this effect has gotten worse in the last 5 years of the study.
It indicates that this may further intensify in the coming 5 years, 10 years, and we may have a dire situation.
He also mentioned that future work could include looking at different categories of drought other than atmospheric drought. So like water availability in streams, aquifers, or soil.
Well, it does sound dire. Now that they've figured this out or think they've figured it out, what can scientists actually do with this information?
Yeah, understanding how this atmospheric thirst affects drought can help people anticipate when it could cause famine, which could give folks a heads up to prepare for impacts to their crops and livestock.
That is Regina Barber and Rachel Carlson from NPR Science Podcast Shortwave, which you can follow for new discoveries and everyday mysteries and all the science behind the headlines. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is NPR News.
Thundering tanks and breathtaking flyovers will roar through our capital city.
President Trump is holding a military parade this weekend for the 250th anniversary of the Army, which is also his birthday. What to expect from the parade and protests and urban planning solutions for floods tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, one reporter's experiment with wearing health tracking technology all over his body.
I probably maxed out at 6 or 7 devices. Let's say it was a Whoop in on one wrist, an Apple Watch on the other, maybe 2 or 3 rings on, and 1 or 2 continuous glucose monitors.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. Israel says it carried out dozens of airstrikes on Iran today. An Israeli official tells NPR the attacks targeted nuclear sites, accusing Tehran of running a secret program to build a nuclear bomb. But the scale of the attack or any damage isn't clear. Iranian state TV says explosions were heard throughout Tehran. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. is not involved in the strikes and that they are focused on protecting American forces in the region. California Senator Alex Padilla was forcibly removed at a Department of Homeland Security news conference when he tried to ask a question. Steve Futterman has more.
Padilla was pushed out of the room by security personnel, taken to the ground and handcuffed. His office posted video of it online. He spoke afterwards.
If this is how the Department of Homeland Security responds to a senator with a question, you can only imagine what they're doing to farm workers, to cooks, to day laborers.
On Fox News, Noam said the action was appropriate.
This man burst into the room, started lunging towards the podium, did not identify himself, and was removed from the room.
Noam called Padilla's action political theater. She says the two did speak later after the incident. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
A federal judge is ordering President Trump to return control of the California National Guard to Governor Gavin Newsom by noon tomorrow, siding with Newsom's argument that Trump erred in how the Guard was being activated. The ruling could still be appealed, but it's a setback for the White House in the dispute over powers it can assert in cracking down on illegal immigration. About a week ago, Trump federalized 4,000 state and National Guard and deployed them and several hundred U.S. Marines to Los Angeles over the objections of Newsom. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In San Antonio, at least 5 people are dead after heavy rains flooded highways and stranded motorists. Officials say 2 people are still listed as missing. Fire crews made dozens of water rescues after those heavy rains. The National Weather Service says the flooding happened after a round of slow-moving showers and thunderstorms early this morning. Heavy machinery and other military equipment is being brought into Washington, D.C. ahead of a large military parade set for this Saturday. The parade is part of a celebration for the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army. But as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, it also happens to fall on President Trump's 79th birthday.
The parade route is set along D.C.'s National Mall, starting near the Lincoln Memorial and ending near the White House. It will include thousands of troops in uniform, dozens of tanks and howitzers, and several Army aircraft. And much of that equipment has needed to be brought in. D.C. resident Pierce Economakis witnessed large trucks carrying tanks and other armored vehicles along a main street in a residential neighborhood in D.C. earlier this week.
It's surreal. It's a little depressing. I think a lot of people forget that people actually live here and it's not, you know, some sort of playground.
Many of D.C.'s roads are already closed for the event, and Reagan National Airport will close for several hours on Saturday to accommodate a flyover. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. Dow futures are down nearly 1.5%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at Subaru.com/care. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. In San Francisco today, a federal judge has ruled in favor of Governor Gavin Newsom, at least for now. That means that President Trump has to return control of the California National Guard back to the Democratic governor. And it also means that President Trump cannot deploy more members of the Guard at this point. These are, of course, the troops that the president called up to respond to protests against immigration enforcement in Los Angeles. KQED political correspondent Marisa Lagos joins us now from San Francisco to talk through this ruling and what this moment means for Governor Newsom. Hi, Marisa.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so what exactly was stated in this ruling today around Trump's federalization of the National Guard?
Yeah, U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer was basically deciding whether to grant the California governor and attorney general a temporary restraining order to pull back the National Guard from these protests that President Trump began to deploy last weekend. You know, those were the demonstrations in Los Angeles in response to immigration enforcement raids. Mm-hmm. And the judge, after this hour-long hearing, agreed with the state and said that Trump had exceeded his authority and ordered the president to return control of the National Guard troops to Newsom at noon tomorrow.
Noon tomorrow. Okay, then what happens at that point?
Yeah, so this is a restraining order. So they'll be considering whether the court will be considering whether to make it a preliminary injunction. So Judge Breyer set a hearing for next Friday to consider that. You know, I will say this is a big win for the state, but we'll have to see what happens in the coming days as protests continue, because the U.S. Marines are still mobilized by Trump, and Judge Breyer did not weigh in on that mobilization. California had asked him to prevent them from patrolling the streets in the coming days, but the judge said they haven't done that yet, and he can't rule on something that hasn't happened. Hmm. And in general, Breyer had pretty tough questions for both sides during this hour-long hearing. A lot of it was focused around whether Trump went through the proper process for calling up the National Guard. He's supposed to go essentially through the governor. And I will say the judge really forcefully pushed back on the federal government's contention that the courts had no place to weigh in on the issue. He said the U.S. was founded in response to a monarch.
Hmm. And has President Trump reacted to this ruling yet?
We haven't seen any reaction yet. Trump and Newsom have been trading insults back and forth on social media and in comments for days now. You know, his lawyers say he has this power to call up the guard, but we don't know what he's going to say. This only came down about 30 minutes ago.
Right. Okay. Well, Marisa, this is obviously a win for Governor Newsom, at least temporarily. As someone who follows the governor closely, what are you making of this political moment for Newsom?
I think it's been a bit of a redemption after a rough few months. You know, the LA fires, a lot of threats from the Trump administration, the widely panned podcast that Newsom started where he was interviewing right-wing provocateurs. You know, this is a moment that I think Newsom kind of relishes, being able to stand up to Trump. And he has been coming out way more forcefully than we've seen in months before this. And I should say things are really tense right now. We saw earlier today Senator Alex Padilla, the Democratic senator from California, get detained, thrown to the ground and handcuffed when he tried to interrupt a news conference DHS Secretary Christine Noem was holding. So a lot of tension right now between California Democrats and this White House.
Indeed. Okay, well, we can't talk about Newsom and his politics without talking about a possible 2028 run for president by Newsom. Where might all of this that has happened recently put Newsom with other Democrats, you think?
You know, I think it's really sort of rallying his base. A lot of Democrats have been sort of looking for, you know, somebody to stand up to this White House. And I think that while there's skepticism nationally of Newsom, this is a moment that he has really stepped up to. And it's not just the speeches, it's the social media back and forth we're seeing. You know, I think it's scary to see armed troops deployed in an American city, no matter how you feel about Trump or immigration. And I think that, you know, as Democrats look for someone to stand up, Newsom's trying to fill that gap.
That is KQED political correspondent Marisa Lagos. Thank you so much, Marisa.
My pleasure.
Today, the House of Representatives voted to claw back 2 years of federal funding for public broadcasting. Largely party-line vote. The bill heads to the Senate next. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh is at the Capitol. She joins us now, and I need to add our usual disclaimer that no NPR News executives had any input into this story. Hi, Deirdre.
Hey there, Mary Louise.
So broadly, this represents, Deirdre, the first request from the Trump administration to claw back, to rescind money that Congress already approved. How much did they cut and which programs?
So this package had a total of $9.4 billion in spending cuts. You already mentioned public media. The bill wipes away the full $1.1 billion Congress approved just months ago in a spending bill that Trump signed for the next two fiscal years. That means if the Senate also approves this bill, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting will not receive any federal money. That's money it uses for grants to public radio and television stations and for programming it supports. Mm-hmm. Direct federal funding makes up roughly 1% of NPR's annual budget, but member stations on average get about 8 to 10% of their budgets from CPB. NPR's president and CEO, Catherine Marr, noted the close vote and bipartisan support in her statement. She urged the Senate to, quote, affirm the very real support for public media across the nation and to reject rescission, maintaining critical services for Americans across the nation.
Now, we said this is a $9 billion package. What about the other $8 or so billion in cuts?
Those target foreign aid, and they cut programs like PEPFAR. It's a global health initiative to combat HIV and AIDS created by President George W. Bush. The bill also cut hunger relief programs at UNICEF, International Disaster Aid. Republicans during today's debate argued that these programs that they were targeting were wasteful. They ticked through some examples of foreign assistance for climate-related programs they said weren't in the U.S. interest. And they said this is just the beginning of Republican efforts to claw back money for programs they oppose. Ohio Republican Jim Jordan summed it up this way.
This bill's real simple. Don't spend money on stupid things and don't subsidize biased media.
Deirdre, let me loop back to public broadcasting, which has been a political hot potato for decades. Congress has debated defunding NPR and PBS for decades. Situate us in this moment.
You're right. I mean, conservatives have been trying to defund public broadcasting for decades, going back, to the 90s. In Trump's second term, there's really been a broad effort as part of his sort of culture wars to label mainstream media organizations. Public media are uniquely vulnerable in this environment. You know, others or corporate media don't need federal funding. Trump targeted NPR and PBS with an executive order back in May, directing CPB not to fund them. He's been arguing the outlets are ideologically biased. During the debate today, Texas Democratic Congressman Lloyd Doggett defended public broadcasters like NPR and PBS for what he said, and said they were targeted for presenting the truth.
Trump doesn't want a country of engaged, informed Americans. He prefers those who salute on command.
Deirdre, in just a sentence or two, this goes next to the Senate. Will they approve it?
It's unclear. If four Republicans break, they can block the bill. Some have expressed concerns with the cuts to global health and public broadcasting.
Right.
They do have a July 18th deadline.
And here's Deirdre Walsh. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Breaking news tonight, Israel says it has launched an attack on Iran, striking dozens of targets around the capital, Tehran. The Israeli military said it was striking at Iran's nuclear facilities and said that Tehran was secretly trying to build a bomb. For the latest, we're joined now by NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Hi, Hadil.
Hello.
So your day has started quite early in Israel.
Yeah, that's right. So it's Friday morning here, and around 3 a.m. we woke up to sirens. Now, those aren't uncommon here because they go off every time the Houthi rebels in Yemen actually attempt to strike Israel. But this time, we also received alerts on our phones that instructed to prepare for a, quote, major threat. And then later, the Israeli military told us that the sirens here were preemptive to allow Israelis to prepare for a possible counterstrike from Iran, since Israel had just launched an attack there. Israel said it was also canceling schools and public gatherings on Friday.
Okay, tell us more. What exactly do we know about Israel's attack so far?
Well, so far we know that people in Iran woke up to large booms around Tehran. There were reports of smoke rising in some neighborhoods there. The Israeli military is calling the attack Operation Rising Lion, and it said that the Air Force launched dozens of attacks targeting nuclear facilities and military targets. An Israeli military official told us this morning that Israel had no choice but to attack Iran, that it had a, quote, gun to its head as Iran built up its nuclear facilities. You know, for years now, Israel has said it won't allow Iran to create a nuclear weapon, something Iran says it doesn't want to do. And then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that the attacks had hit Iran's main enrichment site at Natanz and will keep going for, quote, as many days as it takes to remove this threat.
Well, of course, Adil, this attack came just hours after President Trump said that he did not think an attack was imminent. So did Israel ignore Trump on this one? How much do we know on that front?
I mean, so Israel and the U.S. have lately been at odds on how to deal with Iran's increasing nuclear capabilities. You know, Netanyahu has called for military force all along. But as the U.S., but the U.S. and Iran have been holding rounds of talks in the past weeks about Iran's nuclear program. The U.S. actually wants to strike a deal with Tehran to limit its nuclear capabilities in exchange for lifting sanctions, which have crippled Iran's economy. You know, Iran insists it has no intention to build a nuclear weapon, although the International Atomic Energy Agency said it has enough enriched uranium to theoretically build a bomb. And just yesterday, the same UN nuclear watchdog censored Iran for the first time in 20 years for not complying with its inspections. And then Iran's response was defiant. It announced that it would start a third enrichment site in the country.
Okay, well, given all that context, what has the Trump administration said so far about this attack by Israel?
I mean, there was some foreshadowing this week because on Wednesday, the State Department ordered the evacuation of non-essential staff from the U.S. embassy in Iraq and then authorized their departure from other embassies in the Middle East. President Trump, like we said he didn't actually want Israel to launch an attack, saying it could mess up diplomatic solutions. His envoy, Steve Witkoff, is actually supposed to meet with the Iranian negotiating team in Oman on Sunday. And then this morning, the U.S. State Department released a statement saying it was aware that Israel had, quote, taken a unilateral action against Iran and that the U.S. was not involved in the strikes. It said Israel told the U.S. the action was self-defense.
That is NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much, Hadil.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. One of the ICE raids last week in Los Angeles, which sparked the continuing protests, was at the Ambiance Apparel Company. NPR's Vanessa Romo has been talking to relatives and lawyers for some of the people detained about where they are almost a week later.
Carlos Gonzalez was asleep when the raid at Ambiance Apparel began, but his brother, Jose Paulino Gonzalez, had been at work for hours by the time ICE and the FBI and a slew of other federal officials showed up. In a panic, Carlos raced down to the warehouse in the Fashion District, where he says about two dozen workers had been rounded up and were up against a wall, including his brother, Jose Paulino. He said looking at his face, most people would think the 35-year-old appeared.
Very stoic, very just like calm, but I grew up with him and I was able to see that he was scared.
Gonzalez said he tried shouting to tell his brother he was there, but the chaos around them made it impossible. So he stood there watching as his brother and others were chained at the hands and feet and loaded into white unmarked vans. I said in an emailed statement that they went to the warehouse to serve a federal search warrant, which they clarified by phone was connected to alleged money laundering, tax evasion, and customs fraud. They said they picked up the workers for alleged administrative immigration violations in the process. Those violations can be related to overstaying a visa, entering or re-entering the country illegally, or making false statements on immigration forms. The company's lawyer, Benjamin Gluck, told NPR that Ambiance complies with all applicable laws. A lot of what Carlos Gonzalez knows about the raids come from family and friends whose relatives were also swept up.
I did hear later on that him, along with other co-workers, they tried hiding somewhere. And just knowing that he tried and failed, it hurts.
About a dozen of those taken from Ambiance Apparel come from the same small area in Veracruz, a Mexican state with a large indigenous Zapotec population. Making contact with the workers over the last 6 days has been nearly impossible, according to Gonzalez and Sarai Ortiz. Her father, Jose Ortiz, has also been detained.
He memorized my phone number for this specific reason. He made it like a thing where it's like, I need to memorize your phone number. And he did, which is what is like making me anxious, because I know he knows my phone number. And it's like, why is he not calling me?
At the moment, their attorney says they're being held at the Desert View Annex Detention Center in Adelanto, more than 2 hours away. ICE did not respond to confirm where they're being held. Elena Jung-hee Vermeulen is one of the attorneys working with the Zapotec families.
So far, it's been incredibly hard to access them.
In fact, she says, she's only seen one of the workers and says a different worker was already deported, according to his family, who got a phone call from him when he was released at the border. ICE didn't provide an explanation as to why legal counsel has been unable to meet with most of the Zapotec detainees, and they did not confirm how many of them had been deported. Vermeulen says another factor that may be hindering communication is the cost of actually making the calls.
Families were having to pay upwards of $50 to be able to have phone calls, which is preposterous.
NPR reached out to the company that owns the detention center, Geo Group, for comment. They referred us to ICE, who did not immediately respond. Meanwhile, the families remain distraught. Gonzalez says in addition to trying to get more information about their relatives, they still haven't been able to get the workers' most recent pay. The day of the raid was payday. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
Maybe you have an Oura ring or a Whoop band, a Lingo monitor, a Fitbit, a Garmin watch, or an Apple watch. Maybe you have one or many of these wearable devices that can constantly track your vital statistics. Well, Adam Clark Estes of Vox has a new story out titled, I covered my body in health trackers for 6 months. It ruined my life. Adam is here with us now to tell us all about his ruined life. Hello.
Hi.
So why did you do this, Adam?
That's a great question, and I continue to ask myself that question now that the experiment is over. But long story short, I am getting older, I'm feeling older, and I wondered what kind of technology could help me feel better. And once I started looking, I kind of didn't stop, and I started trying everything, and I did it all at once, and then I wrote about it, because that's my job.
Okay, so at the peak moment, how many devices were attached to your body, would you say?
I probably maxed out at 6 or 7 devices. Let's say it was a Whoop in on one wrist, an Apple Watch on the other, maybe 2 or 3 rings on, and 1 or 2 continuous glucose monitors plugged right into my arm.
Adam likes to accessorize. Okay, so you found positive and negative outcomes from this whole experiment. Let's just start with the positive. When did these devices actually help you feel better or healthier?
They worked best for me when I was asleep. It was the sleep tracking that I actually found made me adopt better habits, get to sleep earlier, sleep more, wake up the next day, and even getting a score that told me how well or poorly I slept somehow made me feel better.
Oh, okay. On the other hand, you did say that as you were tracking, you know, your hours of sleep, the number of steps you were taking, your glucose levels, all of that information started making you anxious. Tell us how.
Health trackers are designed to collect information about you and give you more insight into how your body is doing. But if you don't have a question you're trying to answer, or you don't have a way to kind of interpret that data into actionable items in your life, I found it to be really overwhelming. I didn't know what to do when I was told that my heart rate variability was dropping, which I was told was bad. The most anxiety-inducing data came from the continuous glucose monitor. This is one of the newest health trackers on the market for over-the-counter use. People with diabetes have been using them for years. And it's just not clear to me what to do with that data. And I certainly didn't know what to do when I was told that my blood glucose was spiking after I ate, which is, by the way, a totally normal thing for your blood sugar to do.
So I just want to kind of step back and ask this larger question. Like, why do you think the market for all these health trackers is getting so hot right now? Like, what do you think is going on with all of us?
In the United States, it's well established that we have kind of a healthcare problem. We have a problem with access to health insurance. We have a problem with access to healthcare. So it's no surprise that people might want to get some more information elsewhere. And these devices are becoming increasingly powerful, especially with the help of AI, and they're becoming a lot cheaper.
Right. So do you see a future where everyone has a smartwatch, not exactly because of health concerns, but just because the tech becomes more convenient to get, more affordable, you know, like with smartphones, and we just have to get used to having all of our activity levels tracked all the time, that becomes just the new reality?
I really, really hope that wearing a health tracker continues to be optional. I hope that people can take them off and feel better. But I do think that there is some promise here in these devices helping to, at the very least, kind of serve as a check engine light for people. If you're wearing a health tracker and something goes wrong, the Oura Ring will do this. It has something called the symptoms radar. It told me I was getting sick. And sure enough, about a day later, I got sick. There are a lot of positive things that can come out of wearing a health tracker. And I do think it will become more popular. The tech will get cheaper. It will continue to get better. But what I learned from my experiment is sometimes the thing that made me feel the best was taking it off and just listening to my body.
Adam Clark Estes, senior technology correspondent at Vox. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. lindamoodbell.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century.
You know, I hate to leave y'all, but I'm going to have to go, you know. Yeah, I got a long way to go, but lots of people don't know. I'm going to play this song, and then I'm sure it's going. Because this song means a lot to all y'all. I know you don't know what it means to me.